it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Wait a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 320. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, I'm going to talk to the great Jason Stark, Hall of Famer Jason Stark from The Athletic. We're going to get his thoughts on the Phillies season, what they did during the season, and what may lay ahead for the offseason, as the Phillies have some big decisions to make. We'll talk about this Phillies-Braves series, in which after the first two games of the series, the Phillies have surprisingly won the first two games, and dare I say, have they sucked us back into this whole wild card thing. And we're also going to get into some Matt Klentak comments. He spoke to the media and was on another podcast earlier this week and had some interesting things to say. And I will also have your stat of the week. But first, just a reminder to head on over to the Hittin' Season Patreon, where we have some bonus content for you there. And it's just another way you can support the podcast and what Justin, Liz, and I are doing. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season. And I would also encourage you, if you haven't already, to subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed and tell a friend, hey, listen, convince your friends the Phillies are back in the wild card and tell them to check us out on the Good Fight podcast feed. It's at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, really wherever you get your podcasts. All right, before we get into the Phillies Braves series and before we talk to Jason Stark, I do want to talk about the comments from Matt Klentak this week. He made some comments on a radio.com podcast with John Heyman and Josh Lewin. And then later he also talked to the media, gave some comments to the beat reporters. And we're going to get to those comments here in just a second. But first, I want to play some sound from you from the podcast that he was on with Heyman and Lewin. And he was talking about Gabe Kapler. And John Heyman asked him about whether or not Kapler is in hot water in the eyes of the general manager, and about the fact that Kapler has been such a polarizing figure in Philadelphia.
I think he's far less polarizing now than maybe when he started, and I think that's a credit to him that he's really made adjustments. And I know I've said this before, probably to you, John, but to others in our local market. That, to me, is a sign of a really good leader, is a guy who can gain some experience, learn through the ups and the downs, and make himself better.
Klentak also made it clear that Kapler did a lot to make the team better this year.
And there are so many ways this year that our team has improved in kind of on the margins of small things, and not that small, but our team defense. I think, you know, as much as we've had injury problems in our bullpen, I think Cap has done a really good job, better than really good job, at putting the guys we do have in the best positions to succeed. We're one of the best base running teams in baseball. These are small things that, you know, require effort and attention to detail and coaching and players buying in and executing. And I think as a group, they've done really well. So I think, you know, this, John, and a lot of people know, I'm still very high on Cap. And, you know, I think, you know, despite some of the circumstances we mentioned earlier, I think he's done a nice job this year.
And Klentak said as much after when talking to Phillies beat reporters before the game on Wednesday. But he did note that these guys are all going to be judged based on winning baseball games. And the fair question is, how much of Gabe Kapler's future is actually up to Matt Klentak? I think it's pretty clear, based on these comments and the comments that he made to reporters, that he still believes in Gabe Kapler and that he thinks Gabe Kapler has improved here in 2019. And it's hard to argue with with what he said about the defense getting better and the base running getting better. Those were two areas in 2018 in which the Phillies were the worst in baseball. And they may not be the best in baseball. They may not even be in the top third in baseball in those categories. But the defense and the base running, with the exception of Wednesday night's game in which the Phillies made three errors, generally speaking, the defense has been much improved this year. Bryce Harper in right field has been, I think, even though the defensive metrics may not say so, and this is why I don't like defensive metrics anymore, one of the best right fielders in baseball this year. I think when Andrew McCutchen was in left field, and frankly, Corey Dickerson has played well in left field, that's been way better than Rhys Hoskins in left field last year. Scott Kingery, playing all over the field, has been above average defensively at all of the positions he's played. They've gotten better defense at shortstop with Gene Segura. Cesar Hernandez is Cesar Hernandez, and Rhys Hoskins is Rhys Hoskins. They're never going to be great defensively, but at third base, Michael Franco has been a pretty good defender most of the time. And of course, behind the plate, there may be no better defensive player in baseball at their position than JT Realmuto is at catcher. So defensively, the Phillies have been much improved. We've seen them go first to third a lot more this year. We've seen them go second to home. I wrote about that very early in the season for The Good Fight, the improvements there. So no doubt about it. There are some aspects of this team that are better than last year, but there are also some aspects of this team in which they have regressed. The starting pitching hasn't come around. There have been some questionable decisions made by Kapler with regards to players and their effort level at different times this year. I've questioned some of the lineups, and hey, give Gabe Kapler credit by putting Jose Perella in the lineup in the series opener against the Braves. I hated that decision. We talked about it on Hittin' Season 319, Justin, Liz, and I. We did not want to see Perella or Sean Rodriguez or Gosselin in any of the starting lineups moving forward. We want to see Hazley. We want to see some of the younger guys. And he puts Rodriguez and Perella in the lineup for the series opener, and I was going out of my mind. And Jose Perella hits a game-winning two-run home run to win the game. So you got to give Gabe Kapler credit for that particular decision. I don't like the decision. I would rather have seen Hazley in there, but it worked this time. And so there have been times this year where Kapler has made decisions like that, and they've worked out. Not everything Gabe Kapler has done this year has been bad. And I think that's something that a lot of Phillies fans refuse to acknowledge. Gabe Kapler has not been all bad this year. He's done lots of good things. But has he done enough good things? Have they resulted in enough wins on the field to warrant him coming back? And that, I don't think, is going to be a decision that Matt Klentak makes. I think that's going to be a John Middleton decision. John Middleton got intimately involved in removing John Mailey and putting in Charlie Manuel as hitting coach. So I'm pretty sure that John Middleton is going to be prominently involved in the decision on the Phillies manager next season. But it's pretty clear from these comments, at least, that Matt Klentak fully believes in Gabe Kapler, and it makes sense. These two guys are linked, and Andy McPhail said as much to Matt Klentak when he decided to go with the untested Kapler, that you only get so many managerial choices as a GM, and this is your first of maybe only two. And so Klentak is going to hitch his wagon to Kapler, and Klentak is obviously focusing on the good, which is understandable. But they also are going to have other voices in the organization that are going to provide an overall picture, and we will see how it all shakes out. Now, talking to reporters, Klentak was asked about his offseason, in which I think most of us believed he had a good offseason with the additions that he made, even though most of us believed that the starting pitching probably was not addressed enough. But I wasn't raising red alert. I wasn't on red alert. I thought that Pivetta would take a big step forward this year, and I thought Arrieta would be better this year to go along with Aaron Nola. And then I thought, okay, you know, Eflin showed you a little bit. Velasquez, you could probably give him a little bit more time as a number five starter, but if Arrieta was better and Pivetta took a step forward like I thought would happen, like the Phillies clearly thought would happen, the starting rotation would be okay. It did not turn out that way. Obviously, I was wrong, and obviously, they were wrong. And Klentak indicated that the club not only felt the 18 staff was healthy and effective, but that it could take another step forward, and defended his actions in the offseason. He said, quote, "There's no question that we bet on some improvement from some of those players based on what they had shown in 2018, based on their ages, their development curve, that we thought there would be more improvement than what we've seen. It's hard to look back and second-guess that thought process. It's easy to look back and second-guess the results, just like many Phillies fans have second-guessed." What's annoying about Klentak's comments is, yes, you can second-guess. You can second-guess some of these decisions, because your job as the general manager is to get it right. Your job as the general manager is to get it right. And every decision that is a wrong decision can be defended in the moment it's made most of the time. But if you're going to be the GM of a winning team, you got to take full responsibility and just say, you know what, it wasn't good enough. But there is an absolute inability by really anyone in this organization to admit a mistake, to admit they screwed up, that they didn't do what they needed to do. They were super aggressive in this offseason. And then when they got into the season, they were not. They pulled back. They didn't think the wild card was worth winning. That's really what this comes down to. They did not feel the wild card was worth winning. And again, I can't stress this enough. I agreed with not trading Alec Bohm or Spencer Howard or Mickey Moniak for Tanner Roark. I understand why the Phillies did not make those moves. I do. But the I keep coming back to the McPhail comments of if we don't, we don't. That was the overall tenor of the season here once it got away from them a little bit. And so they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to say, well, we had an objectively excellent offseason and made all these moves. I mean, you signed Bryce Harper to a 13-year deal. You traded for 2 years of JT Realmuto. There's no guarantee he re-signs. And when you made that deal, you knew we might only have him for 2 years, and 2019 is one of those years. The bottom line is this team didn't do well enough. And they could have done more at the trade deadline, and they didn't. They did not. They could have gone out and made moves to fix the relief pitching the way that the Braves and the Nationals did without really giving anything up, and they decided not to. They could have signed Dallas Keuchel as a free agent and decided not to. For better or worse, they could have signed Craig Kimbrel to a 3-year deal, and they decided not to. They played it safe. After an aggressive offseason, they came into the season, and when they realized it was just going to be the wild card, they played it safe. The wild card was not worth winning. And they may say that that's not the case, that they've been pushing. They added Corey Dickerson. The guys that they added, they were all absolutely no-risk moves. If you're going to be a successful general manager who puts together a winning team, you've got to do more than no-risk moves. So stop trying to sell me that adding Mike Morin and Blake Parker and Jared Hughes and promoting Nick Vincent from AAA and bringing in Corey Dickerson for nothing was enough. It clearly wasn't. So at some point in this organization, somebody is going to have to take the reins and say, I'm responsible. I'm responsible for this, and we're going to go after this thing. I mean, everybody likes to point to the fact that the Phillies season tickets went dramatically up this year because they brought in Harper and brought in all these. They brought in a lot of veteran guys, guys who are not going to be with this team forever. The window's open. It's here. And they listen, you make up 2 games in 2 days, 2 days against the Atlanta Braves. Maybe they still make it in this year. I'm still working under the assumption that with the playoff odds at around 1%, it's probably not happening. And if it doesn't happen for this team this year, it's not a stepping stone. It is a failure, especially when they could have done more at the trade deadline, when they could have done more in season. Yes, we can go back and we can evaluate whether they evaluated their starting pitching wrong. And I think we all agree that I misevaluated and they misevaluated their starting pitching. Maybe it was because of bad coaching. Maybe all of the signs were there and a better pitching coach gets more out of these guys. I don't know. That's something they're going to have to figure out this offseason. But I'm really tired of hearing Matt Klentak and Gabe Kapler and Andy McPhail talk about the positives when it's clear not enough was done. Not enough is getting done. I'm really tired of hearing Matt Klentak try to sell me on how hard the job is. And all, at some point as a general manager, you are going to have to win baseball games. This cannot continue to be a 10-year rebuild to the postseason. They keep saying how they wanted it to be the fastest rebuild in baseball history and match the Cubs and the Astros. That's not happening. They sold this fan base that they were going to be better. And right now, they might be a couple of games better, but not better enough. And when you look at the gap between where this team is and where the Atlanta Braves are, it's a yawning gap. And I don't know how they make up for it this offseason. They're going to try, but I don't know how they make up for it this offseason. So Klentak's comments annoyed me. Because I don't like trying to be sold a bill of goods. The team wasn't good enough this year. And he didn't do enough in season to fix it. Jason Vargas has largely been terrible since joining the Phillies. Drew Smyly has not really been all that good. He's had a couple good starts and then a few starts where he has absolutely been a disaster. And the bullpen at times has been good, but the bullpen has also leaked oil tremendously. And I think the Phillies could have done more to address the bullpen without giving up a ton of top prospects here. I also thought something Klentak said about Scott Kingery in the Radio.com podcast was very interesting. If you had any notions of Kingery becoming a full-time second baseman next year, I would not get my hopes up, gang, because it sounds as though Klintak and the Phillies really value him and love him as a super utility guy.
I actually think in a lot of respects, Scott Kingery is one of our most valuable players. And it's not from a war calculation or the highest batting average or the high, you know, anything like that. It's because of the flexibility that he provides Cap on a daily basis and really what he provides the front office from a roster building perspective. When you have a player that is an above average offensive player, as Scott is, who can play above average defense at, you know, in center field, third base, shortstop, second base, heck, you could probably do it, you know, in left field, right field, or first too. We just haven't really seen him much out there. That is just an incredibly valuable player, you know, for a franchise.
And just to put it into broader context, remember, Kingery has played 10 games at second base, 34 at third base, 13 at shortstop, 7 in left, and 58 games in center field. He could be back as this team's super utility guy next year and not necessarily the everyday second baseman. Now, I do not think the Phillies are going to bring Cesar Hernandez back. I think his arbitration number is going to be far more than what the Phillies want to pay for the production level that Cesar Hernandez gives them. But that doesn't automatically mean that Kingery is going to be the starting second baseman. If you look on the free agent market, there are some other options for the Phillies at that particular position, although none of them are really fantastic. But you could go back and get Howie Kendrick. Jonathan Scope becomes a free agent. He has an OPS near 800. But again, you're not getting a lot of offensive production out of a lot of these guys here. Eric Sogard has an OPS of 810 for Tampa this year, but he's 34. Maybe you sign him on a one-year deal. You know, it makes a lot of sense for the Phillies to go with Kingery as the everyday second baseman, but are they going to want to give up that flexibility? Man, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. And so they might get creative at second base and think of something else. That maybe they overthink it. I don't know. But it sure sounds like the Phillies really love the Ben Zobrist-like performance that Scott Kingery gave them this year. And I know that he's struggled this month. He's had a slugging percentage over 500 for most of the season, but he has just a 607 OPS going into Wednesday's game in September with just 5 extra base hits. I think the guy's just running out of gas. But I think Kingery certainly was one of the positives from this season, and I don't think it's a guarantee he's going to be your everyday second baseman based on Klintak's comments. So Klintak had some other things to say. I recommend you checking out basically all the beat writers put out a piece on some of his comments. He had some interesting things to say about JT Realmuto. It sure sounds as though they are going to work hard to sign him to an extension this coming offseason. I think that gets done. We'll see exactly for how much. But obviously, the Phillies are going to be focusing on improving the starting pitching and getting some bullpen pieces, and whether that means Gerrit Cole or trading for somebody else remains to be seen. But obviously, the big things we're going to be watching for here this offseason are re-signing JT Realmuto, Gabe Kapler's future with the team, and how this team improves their pitching staff, because that's going to be the difference between them getting to the postseason in 2020 and not. And coming up here in just a second, I'm going to talk to Jason Stark a little bit more about all of that. Plus, I'm going to get his thoughts on the National League playoff picture. That's up next, right here on Hittin' Season. And joining us to talk a little bit about the Phillies and the upcoming postseason, which is just a couple of weeks away, is the great Jason Stark, Hall of Fame baseball writer for The Athletic, host of the Athletic podcast that he does with Doug Glanville, Starkville, which is now on Apple Podcasts, by the way, in-studio host at MLB Network, host of Baseball Stories at Stadium, and of course, you probably already follow Jason on Twitter, but if you don't, it's at JasonST. Jason Stark, Hall of Famer. How does that sound? Welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you, my man?
John, I'm good. I'm still trying to get used to the fact that everybody just refers to me casually as Hall of Famer,
right?
Jason Stark. No, I'm not.
Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, Jason Stark. It's just fantastic.
Not quite.
Congratulations. I mean, what an honor and what a great summer for you. And I can't imagine. I know you've talked about it a lot, so I did want to congratulate you on it and just say, you know, it's been amazing work you've done over the decades. So
I appreciate it, man. I'd say it's been awesome, but it's been more awesome than that.
I can believe it.
Fantastic.
But anyway, let's jump into things here, and let's talk a little bit about the Phillies before we get into the rest of Major League Baseball in the postseason, of which it does not look like the Phillies are going to be a part of this time around. Jason, Yeah, when those Fangraphs odds get underneath 1%, it's time to start circling the wagons, I think. And obviously, you know, they're still mathematically alive, but the deck is extremely stacked against them this week. I'm operating under the assumption that it's not going to happen. And now we're starting to assess blame. You know, why didn't this season end in a postseason berth? Everybody came into the season thinking that if this team wasn't a division winner, it would at least get a playoff spot. They were an 89, 90, 91 win team, and they're going to finish with far less than that. And I could ask you what one thing is most to blame, but I don't know that I've been able to get anyone to pin it on one thing in particular. So I guess what I want to ask you is, did we overrate this team coming into the season, or did just a lot of bad stuff happen?
I mean, I think all that's true. I actually think all of that. I personally, believe it or not, never thought this was a playoff team coming out of spring training. Thought it would... I just didn't think it was a 90-win kind of team. I saw the flaws, I guess, in a way that a lot of people in Philadelphia didn't. I thought that this would be a much-improved offense. I did not see a playoff-ready pitching staff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's obviously one of the things that's gone wrong, is they made a bet on the rotation as it ended last year, and that was a big mistake. That was a massive miscalculation to bring that rotation back intact and just assume that the underlying metrics would allow everybody to take a step forward. I think the part of the team that's the most easily explained is the bullpen, because there have been so many injuries. I think the part that's the least easily explained is the offense. I honestly thought that they would do kind of what the Twins have done, maybe not hit 300 homers, but just be a collection of dangerous hitters up and down the lineup and be able to just outslug people when they needed to. There's been very little of that, and somebody's going to have to figure out what went wrong there.
Yeah, you know, as I look back on this season, and I think as we all look back on this season, this Philly season, really, in the season of the home run, when Major League Baseball set a new record for home runs, the Phillies did not take part in that as an offense. They are 22nd in Major League Baseball in home runs. But then when you flip it over to the pitching staff has, unfortunately, they have participated in the home run barrage for much of the season. They led the National League in that number, and as things stand coming into Thursday, the Phillies have given up the fifth most home runs in baseball, and that gap, that separation to me is, I think, a big part of where the season was lost.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, because, you know, this has been the season of the homer, and if you look at the top seven teams in the big leagues and homers, what do they all have in common? They're all going to the playoffs, and the team that's eighth is the Brewers. They might be going too. That's how teams score now. It is not how the Phillies have scored. They're 11th in the league in homers, and in a year where, you know, at least half the teams in baseball are going to set their single season franchise home run records, the Phillies are not one of those. And I still don't understand exactly what went wrong, and I defend John Mailey all the time, because he was the hitting coach of a team that won the World Series with the Cubs 3 years ago. So it's not that he wasn't bad at his job. He, for whatever reason, he did not mesh with this group of hitters. They'd been a little better since Charlie Manuel has had that job, but there's a lot more talent on the field than the stats would indicate. They're going to finish eighth in the league in runs scored. That just blows my mind.
And I guess what the Phillies have to figure out is this personnel-based? Is just a one-year aberration? Was it coaching? And obviously 1 month of Charlie Manuel, I don't know, is enough to get the answers to all of those questions. I know you said that you didn't think this was a pitching staff that was built to go to the playoffs at the beginning of the season, but at one time they were 11 games over, and they did have a lead in the National League East, and then things fell down from that. Was Andrew McCutchen going out for the season, was that the turning point, or was this just kind of like a once those relievers started dropping like flies that it just became unsustainable?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing. It's, you know, you laid this out when we first started talking, and that was a tipping point. They've never been able to solve the leadoff spot since Andrew McCutchen went down. The lineup hasn't flowed quite the same since Andrew McCutchen went down. That was obviously a big factor in the season, and yet there was not a lot of hoopla when they signed Andrew McCutchen.
No.
You know, he turned out to be a way better piece of the puzzle than I think most people in the town thought coming into the season. And so it's so ironic that people are so devastated by his injury now. But there's just been so many things. I don't even know where to start. Suppose they hadn't lost those 14 games in their last at bat. Suppose they'd lost half that many. I mean, that's a bullpen thing, and that's a get a big hit late in the game thing, and they didn't do either of those things. What if they were better than 10th in the league in starting pitching ERA? What if they'd made some moves at the deadline to add starting pitching? It's been a mess since then.
Yeah.
They thought Jason Vargas was as good as Dallas Keuchel. Really? I think we can argue that one.
Yeah.
What if they hadn't gone 7-9 against the Marlins? The Braves and Nationals are 28-7 against the Marlins. There's just so much stuff that's added up.
Yeah.
So much.
Well, and I guess now we kind of look forward at this point because we could try and pinpoint, what was the turning point. But that's all in the past. And obviously identifying what the issues are helps you come up with solutions for the offseason and the future. But a lot of people are going to ask whether or not the manager should be back, whether or not the general manager should be back. And I don't like calling for people to lose their jobs, and I don't call for people to be fired when I'm doing the podcast or when I'm writing anything. But I guess I wanted to think about what is your insight on what the Phillies' thinking is right now regarding Gabe Kapler and Matt Klentak. Do you think that these last 2 weeks will factor into any of their decision-making?
I'm really not a fan of suggesting that people deserve to be fired too. That's a great talk show radio thing. It's not my thing.
Right.
I like both guys, and I'm always uncomfortable in these types of conversations. But I don't think at this point this is a decision that will be based on the last 2 weeks of the season, because at this point, John Middleton and whoever's going to make these calls, they know how the season's gonna end. They're making that decision, whatever decision they make, based not on a small sample but on a really large sample, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 2 years, whatever period of time you want to choose. And I'm being honest with you, John, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I keep using the expression anything is possible, because I think that's true. When John Mailey got fired as the hitting coach, is there anyone who believes that that did not come from John Middleton?
No.
I don't. it's never been stated. It's never been admitted to. But clearly, he drove that change. And whatever emotions, whatever conclusions drove him to call for that to happen could literally result in him calling for almost anything else to happen that you can imagine. I find it impossible to believe that the entire coaching staff and the entire front office will be back as it looks right now. But there's a massive debate going on inside those walls about what they should do, and I think a lot's going to come down to who gets to decide. I don't get the vibe that Matt Klentak thinks the manager deserves to get fired based on how the season's unfolded. But, it might not be his call. And then if it's not his call, what does that mean?
Yeah. No, those are all fair questions. And I think you're right. John Middleton drove the train on John Mailey is what I think happened. And if he was willing to get involved in a positional coaching decision, you would imagine that he'll get involved in decisions on personnel a little higher than John Mailey, for sure.
He'll be involved. Yeah, I think he'll be involved.
Last thing on the Phillies. So obviously there's some ground to make up here this offseason. The Phillies had an unbelievably busy offseason last winter, signing Harper and signing McCutchen, and David Robertson, who we all forget about, was a big free agent signing, and they got 7 innings out of him this year. and then trading for Segura and Real Muto. Obviously, I think signing Real Muto to an extension has to be job number one this offseason. But what do the Phillies have to do to close the gap between them and the Braves, and I would even say the Nationals, too?
Yeah. You know, it's hard to look at the Braves roster and system and look at the Phillies roster and system and convince yourself that there is a move or a couple of moves or three moves that magically make the Phillies better than the Braves. And, you know, the Nationals, I think they're a little closer, but the Nationals are really well set up for the future. Like, I look at the age of the Braves, major leaguers. Ronald Acuna is 21. Mike Soroka is 21. Ozzy Albies is 22. Austin Riley is 22. Dansby Swanson is 25. Even Freddie Freeman is still in his 20s. I mean, that team's going to be good for a really long time, and they've got a ton of arms in their system. So to try to catch the Braves is a really tall order. Well, that doesn't mean you can't make the playoffs. I think, considering where they set the bar for this year, next year they have to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
And that means there are a lot of decisions to make. I think, for example, third base. There was a time when I thought they'd be hot and heavy in that Anthony Rendon market, but Alex Bohm made so much progress. I think he's clearly on the radar screen for next year sometime, but not opening day. So who plays third while you're waiting for him? I don't see how it can be Mike Alfranco. What do they do at second? Do they trade Cesar Hernandez? Are they better off having Scott Kingery bounce around the field than playing second every day? What happens in the outfield? Is Andrew McCutchen healthy? Can he play center field? Is there some way that the puzzle pieces could be fit together so Corey Dickerson would be part of it? Can they fix Rhys Hoskins' swing? Spencer Howard is a guy who has a chance to be a star in that rotation behind Aaron Nola, but how much can they expect to get out of him next year? He pitched 71 innings this season. So these are huge decisions over and above. Who are they going to sign? How much money are they going to spend? Who can they trade to upgrade rotation? I mean, this is a lot to do.
Sounds like it might even be busier than last offseason, which is really hard to imagine.
Well, in some ways, I think, if we go back to the beginning of this, if they had described this year as another big step in a process that was leading to something special, rather than make it feel like this was the year, I think in their hearts they knew this was not the year,
mm-hmm.
People might perceive this differently. But the town is, you know, had such high expectations and is being so Philadelphia-esque in the way it's reacting to what actually happened.
Yeah.
That I think they've got damage control to do there. You got to rebuild fan enthusiasm because a lot of that was lost.
Yeah. No, it has been. You've seen it in the cable TV ratings. I've seen it in the podcast numbers. I mean, it's just Phillies fans have lost interest in the attendance. You know, for the last week, they were in a wild card chase before, you know, when Boston and Atlanta were in town, and there really wasn't much of a crowd there because I think Phillies fans have kind of disengaged at this point in the season.
Yeah, they don't believe.
They don't.
Sure.
Real quick, looking around the National League wild card, I really enjoyed the piece you wrote for The Athletic this week talking about the Brewers. And what they're doing is amazing right now because having lost Christian Yelich for what it seems certain to be the entire season, even if they make it to the World Series, they've been the hottest team in the National League. And you wrote about how crazy their postseason could be as the catalyst for team entropy with all of the tiebreakers that they could be facing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a scenario where they play five games in five different cities in 5 days in all four time zones. I've never heard of anything like that. I mean, the Rockies had a little taste of it last year, but not to that degree. You know, if there's a three-way tie or a four-way tie that they're mixed up in, they got to finish the season in Colorado on Sunday, then they'd be playing potentially tiebreaker games Monday and Tuesday. That could be Central Time Zone. That could be Eastern Time Zone. They could play the wild card game Wednesday in the Eastern or Central Time Zone. And then, because the National League wild card game would have to be bumped back a day, they'd have to play division series in L.A. on 0 days rest.
Oh, man.
You know, play, win, travel across the country, and play. That's a crazy road. It's a, you know, it's a fun road. You don't have to live it.
Right, exactly.
Potentially,
fun for us.
Potentially 5,000 miles worth of traveling in 5 days.
That's not good for the environment, Jason. I'm just here to tell you.
Yeah, but we don't care about that right now.
No, not at all.
And you have to give that team a ton of credit because they lost the MVP. They were behind the Phillies. They never lose.
Yeah, we were waiting for one of these teams to get hot, right? All these teams that were in that 2.5-game window of the wild card, we knew one of these teams would probably get hot and separate themselves, and amazingly, it was the Brewers.
I agree. Their group is special. The manager is special. The GM, David Stearns, is one of the smartest young executives in the business, and he doesn't listen to the noise. They don't listen to the noise. They did this last September, which I think fuels belief. It's been incredible what they've done. Now, that you know, people say, well, they've got this easy schedule the rest of the way, and it is easy in some ways, but they do have to finish the season in Cincinnati and in Colorado. Do they have enough pitching to get through that? Because those are two ballparks that can really take their toll on pitching staffs.
Last thing for you, how likely is it that the two MVP awards go to two players who will not have played at any point in the last 2 weeks of the season?
Well, almost the last three.
Yeah, right, with Trout and Yelich.
I think Mike Trout is going to win. I'm always open to waiting on this to see what happens, and I think he looks like he's got enough of a statistical advantage over Alex Bregman, DJ LeMay, who, you know, pick your favorite MVP candidate, that I think he's going to win, given the way voters vote now in the year 2019, as opposed to the way they voted in 1999 or 79 or 39 when the best player on the team that had the best record would win. Alex Bregman would have won then. Mm-hmm. Whether Christian Yelich is going to win, that's a tough one because the narrative is almost always a part of MVP voting.
Yeah.
I'm a National League MVP voter myself, and, you know, maybe Anthony Rendon might not quite have the numbers of Yelich and Bellinger, but he might have the narrative. Mm. So I think he's somebody to talk about and think about. And, you know, then you've got this whole new age aspect to the NL debate where clearly Christian Yelich has had the better offensive year than Bellinger. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Bellinger has been such an impact defender.
Yeah.
You've got to really believe in defensive metrics to say that he's had a better, more valuable season. Those are the least reliable metrics in the world.
Yeah, they are.
So it's a tough one, man. I'm going to say they both won't win, but they probably both should win.
Well, it'll be fascinating because I don't know what the record is, and I want to look this up unless somebody's already done it. But, has there been an MVP that's missed the last 3 weeks? When is the last time an MVP award was given to a player who missed the last 3 weeks? And, what's the longest gap there's been of a player who missed the end of the season and then won the MVP award?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. That's on my research project for the week.
There you go.
we've done some research on MVPs with the fewest at bats, and go look at George Brett in 1980.
Yeah, he hit 390 that year, didn't he?
Yeah, he hit 390, and he didn't have. He wasn't even close to having 500 plate appearances.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think he played 100 some odd games that year.
Yeah, exactly, and so. You know, there is precedent for that. Should it matter that those 3 weeks you miss are at the end of the season and not at the beginning of the season or the middle of the season? You know, that's a big part of the argument. But as I said, I voted in a lot of MVP elections, and narrative feeds into it. Last year it did.
Yeah.
Did you know, this is my favorite stat of last year, Christian Yelich accumulated more wins above replacement in the last week of the season last year than Bryce Harper accumulated in the entire season last year.
Wow. That's insane. That is a fantastic stat. I hadn't heard that one before. Wow.
I've thrown it out there a bunch of times. Take notes out there.
Well, listen, if you're not following Jason on Twitter, I don't know what you're doing with your life. It's at Jason ST. Follow his work in The Athletic. Listen to his podcast that he does with the great Doug Glanville called Starkville. Watch him on the MLB Network. Check out Baseball Stories at Stadium. Jason, thanks for coming on Hitting Season again. I appreciate it.
John, always enjoyed it, man. Thanks.
Well, up next, some news and notes from the first two games of the Phillies-Braves series, heading into the series finale, in which Aaron Nola will take the mound. We'll do that next, right here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So as the Phillies and Braves finish up their three-game series, Justin and Liz will have more on this series and the third game of the series, pitched by Aaron Nola on Continued Success, which should be out on Friday morning. But I wanted to get this out after the first two games because the Phillies have made up two games in 2 days thanks to two straight wins to start this series, as well as losses by the Brewers and Cubs. Man, baseball just wants the Phillies to stay in this for as long as humanly possible, don't they? And have they sucked you in? I have to know. There's a small part of me, a very tiny small part, that has sucked me back in. But I put out a poll on Twitter, and it's still got a couple hours left, so I'll be interested to see what it looks like at the very end. But with a couple hours in the early morning hours on Twitter, I asked, are the Phillies sucking you back in again? And not 200 people have responded so far. 56% of you say no, 44% say yes. So most of you listening, if I can extrapolate these numbers over the entire listenership of the podcast, about 56% of you are not getting sucked back in. And that's probably wise, because the odds are still incredibly low. But at the very least, the Phillies are giving you a reason to keep watching. Maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe they're just torturing all of us, you know, just to finish off the 2019 season. But this is what we wanted. We wanted a team that was playing meaningful games in September. And you know what? That's what they're giving us. They're giving you a reason to watch this game on Wednesday afternoon. They're giving you a reason to tune in to the game in Cleveland. And so that is, I guess, a step forward, because last year they didn't do that. They absolutely tanked. And here at the end of this season, maybe they're starting to put it together a tiny little bit. Really, the offense has not been good in this Atlanta series, although they did win, and they'll be going for the sweep with Aaron Nola on the mound. The Phillies have lost his last five starts. They absolutely have to win this game on Wednesday afternoon if they want to continue to keep our hopes up. You can't lose six Aaron Nola starts in a row. I mean, come on. They've got to win this game on Wednesday afternoon, and imagine what a series sweep of Atlanta would do right now. The Phillies are oddly 10-8 versus Atlanta coming into this finale, and so they've officially won the season series. Now, three of those wins came in the first three games of the season when the Braves were still getting their feet under them, and after that series, the Braves had massively outplayed the Phillies, but not this week. And before this week, as noted by Matt Gelb on Twitter, this is the first series the Phillies have won in Atlanta since August of 2017. And as Stark mentioned, that record really hurts. If the Phillies beat Atlanta and go to 11-8 on the season, it's going to be even more painful that the Phillies are 7-9 against Miami this year. I mean, really, if the Phillies miss out on a playoff spot, they can look at their record against losing teams, which is only a handful of games, two or three games over 500, because they've played over 500 against winning teams. I think they're four games over 500 against winning teams, or three games over 500 against winning teams. If they had done better against the teams they were supposed to beat, this would be a playoff team. And that's what's been so frustrating about this season. The Phillies won Wednesday night's game with pitching and homers, two things that they really have not been good at as other teams this year. I talked a little bit about that with Jason just a second ago with the home runs. But Bryce Harper hit his 32nd of the season off Julio Teheran, a dude he flat out owns. But Zach Eflin was the story on Wednesday, and he's playing himself into the rotation in 2020. He went seven innings, gave up one run, even though his defense behind him made three errors. And his last five starts, over 28 and two-thirds innings, he has a 1.57 ERA, a 1.01 whip, and a .217 batting average. Could you just imagine if Zach Eflin and Aaron Nola had actually pitched well together at the same time this year? When Eflin was great in April, Nola was terrible. And When Nola got hot, Eflin was terrible. Now the same thing's happening in September. As Nola has struggled here and there, although he was very good in his last start, Eflin has really picked it up. So just get these two guys going at the same time. This is all coinciding with Eflin going back to his sinker as his main pitch. And he got grounder after grounder after grounder on Wednesday night. Even though the Phillies made three errors behind him, he really gutted it out. And Gabe Kapler was gushing about Eflin and his stick-to-itiveness and his testicular fortitude. That's my phrase, not his. And I think he's playing himself into the rotation in 2020. By going against what Chris Young and the rest of the Phillies pitching staff wants pitchers to do, he's not going to be a guy that elevates his fastball in the strike zone. He's going to be a ground ball guy. He's going to be a sinker guy. Now, unlike Kyle Kendrick, Eflin throws a little harder. His sinker has a little bit more bite to it. So Kyle Kendrick would get into these runs where his sinker would really be working well, and he'd have five or six starts where he had a 2.5 ERA, and then he'd have 10 or 11 starts where he had a 7 ERA. So that's the thing with a sinker ball pitcher. If you can be consistent with it, then you can be effective even in this game of launch angle, like Zach Eflin has been over the last five games. It's when you start elevating that sinker and leaving it up in the zone is when pitchers get into trouble, and Zach Eflin hasn't had that happen to him, but that's what always used to get Kyle Kendrick, and that's what always used to foul him up because he didn't throw hard. Now, Eflin throws a little bit harder. His secondary stuff is a little bit better than Kyle Kendrick's, but I think at the very least, because the Phillies are going to basically need three starting pitchers, if not four starting pitchers next year, you have to assume Arrieta is going to be back. Maybe they add three guys from elsewhere, but I think Zach Eflin is going to be a guy that they bring back. He certainly has been the most promising between Velasquez, Pivetta, and Eflin. Between those three guys, he's had the most positive moments in 2019. Kapler did talk about Velasquez because Velasquez got the start in the series opener, and it was a typical Velasquez game in the 5-4 win. He gave up two runs in the first inning. It was an extremely laborious first inning. Guys were hitting him around. He wasn't getting any swings and misses. And then he pitched four scoreless innings. And guys started generating a lot more swing and miss in the four innings after that. And Kapler said of Velasquez, according to a piece by Matt Gelb in The Athletic, "I think Vince has established himself as a guy who can stick at the back end of a rotation and give you five, six innings when he's right. I think he's established himself as credible in that role for 2 years straight. I think there's still a tremendous amount of upside there, and I don't think he's done developing by any stretch. I think with some continued development, he could earn an even more impactful role, and I think we have a lot to learn. He's got three starts left," talking about three starts left this season. Now, are we really talking about putting Velasquez back in the starting rotation next year and giving him another 30 starts? I'm just out on this, guys. I mean, I know Velasquez, and there was an interesting stat from Gelb's piece that I wanted to pass along. He's pitched at least five innings in 59 of his 90 starts for the Phillies. So 60 out of 90, that's about two-thirds of starts. It's almost exactly two-thirds. He has a 3.02 ERA in those games. So almost two-thirds of the time over four seasons, he's been better than the league average. But in the other third of his starts, 31 out of 90, he hasn't reached five innings, and he has a 10.23 ERA in those outings. That's just not going to get the job done. And I think the Phillies, if they want to be a playoff team, they're going to have to decide between Eflin or Velasquez in the five spot and then go out and improve in the three and four spot or in the two and three spot. And you make Arrieta your four or something like that. But they've got to go out and they've got to make improvements in this rotation. Velasquez and Eflin cannot start every fifth day. It's got to be, if you're going to do anything, if you're going to keep any of those guys, you got to decide on one. And I think Eflin has shown way more than Velasquez. And I still believe Velasquez can be an effective relief pitcher. That he never really got the chance to do that here in 2019. Some other notes before we wrap up here. Corey Dickerson is out for the season with a broken foot. In 34 games for the Phillies, he had .293, only a .307 on-base percentage, but a .579 slugging percentage with 8 homers, 34 RBIs, only 0.3 wins above replacement according to Baseball Reference because of that low on-base percentage and some poor defensive metrics according to them. Again, I throw that stuff out the window, and it's why I look at WAR with a side glance nowadays is because I just don't trust the defensive metrics that go into making up WAR. I think you still have to use WAR. I still use it, but I kind of take it along with all of the other numbers that I see. An OPS plus of 120 makes him one of the more effective Phillies hitters since he was acquired. I still have a hard time seeing him coming back, because I don't see how either him or McCutchen can play center field. So unless the Phillies decide that McCutchen, on a surgically repaired knee, can play center field, I just don't see it. And I think the Phillies have really benefited from having improved defense in the outfield this year, with Haseley providing a ton of great defensive plays from center. I would love to see Haseley as the starting center fielder, and I just don't see a way to bring Dickerson back in 2020. But we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. Alec Bohm won the Paul Owens Award this week as the organization's top minor league hitter. No surprise there. Bohm hit 305, 378, 518 with 21 homers, 30 doubles, 80 RBIs in 125 games at three levels between low A Lakewood and double A Redding. And left-hander Ethan Lindau won it as the top minor league pitcher. He's 20 years old. Was a 2017 fifth-round pick for the Phillies. He had a 2.52 ERA, a 1.01 whip in 26 games, 16 starts at Lakewood and High A Clearwater. He kind of modeled himself after Tom Glavine, and some Phillies insiders say that's the kind of pitcher he could be if everything breaks right. Josh Bonifay, the Phillies' director of player development, called him, quote, a special pitcher. We'll just have to wait and see about that. The Phillies have not developed many special pitchers over the years. And the Arizona Fall League is underway. Bohm and Spencer Howard and Mickey Moniak and some others are participating. Moniak got a single in his first Arizona Fall League plate appearance. Howard will make five starts. He'll throw a max of five innings or 75 pitches in each of his starts in order to manage his workload, which will leave him with about 96 innings pitched this year. And it's questionable how much of a jump he can make next year in innings pitched. I don't think they'd want to pitch him more than 130, 140 innings next year. That'd be a jump of about 50 innings if he did that much. And actually, but more like 40 innings. If it's about 140 innings next year, that's about a jump of 40 to 45 innings. I think that would be substantial, and I don't know that they'd want to push him all that much. So even if he does get into the Phillies starting rotation next year, you got to believe there would be an innings limit, and he might not be available to the team towards the latter part of the year. So maybe they have him start the season in May if the Phillies believe he can be a part of a late season run or something like that. It's something to monitor for next year, because I don't think it's a guarantee he starts the season right away. He might get extended spring training and start in May, just so the Phillies might have him and they don't have to have a Steven Strasburg type situation on their hands. All right, time for our stat of the week. This from Megan Montemuro. Nola, who gets the start on Wednesday, is just the ninth Philly and the youngest at 26 years old to record multiple 200 strikeout seasons in his career. Since 1912, there have been just two other 200 strikeout seasons by a Philly aged 26 or younger. Cole Hamels in 2010 and Brett Myers in 2005. And folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My profound thanks to Hall of Famer Jason Stark for coming on the podcast. And a reminder, if you haven't done so, gang, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is you get your podcasts and subscribe, leave a rating and a review for the Good Fight Podcasts. And don't forget to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.